Good afternoon, everyone here over in Europe, and good morning, everyone that's dialing in from the States. Thank you very much for calling in today. This is the first of our Brexit update calls. My name is Tim Pearce. I am a partner in the investment management group here in London at Akin. I'm joined today by Ian Mead, a fellow partner in the investment management group, and Chris Leonard, who is a partner in our regulatory group. We appreciate that obviously many of you are going to be very busy given what's happening in the markets, so we're going to keep this call relatively brief today. First off, we're going to talk about the legal process of Brexit from here and the timing and where we go today. Ian is then going to look at the medium-term effects on essentially the raft of legislation affecting the asset management industry, whether it's UK asset managers, European asset managers, or non-European asset managers operating in the EU. Chris is going to then talk about some of the sort of more short-term legislative effects and also what might be on the short-term regulatory agenda as well. And finally, we're just going to round up with some short-term fund-related liquidity management issues. So just talk about process at the moment. As I'm sure you'll have all seen, the vote wasn't close. And because the vote wasn't close, the general consensus, which we agree with here, is that there's little chance at this stage of any kind of judicial review type challenge to the result. It seems as if the Remain side have accepted the result and there's no appetite to challenge it. The question is, where do we go from here? You probably have heard of Article 50. It's been mentioned a lot of the Treaty of European Union. What is Article 50? Article 50 is little more than a trigger, really, for a two-year period to begin for a country to leave the EU. It was introduced in the Treaty of European Union after, in the 1980s, Greenland left. And it is in no way designed to deal with an exit of the magnitude of the UK's exit. Couple of points to make here. There's very little process in Article 50. It doesn't really set out in any great detail the steps you have to go through, what you have to do to extricate yourself from the European Union. And importantly, what it also doesn't deal with is the actual triggers of Article 50 of succession. It doesn't lay out a timetable for a member state that's decided to leave by which it has to adhere. So there's a lot of discussion at the moment here in the UK about when Article 50 will be triggered. Now, Cameron, in his resignation speech, stated that that was likely to be possibly October, just before the, or just after the European, the Conservative Party conference. The leaders of the Leave Party have been at pains, or the Leave movement, I should say, have been at pains to say that they don't want to trigger Article 50 immediately. That is somewhat at odds with the, I guess, more popular part of Leave, who want to get out as soon as possible and who want Article 50 triggered as soon as possible. There's a lot of rhetoric coming out of the various institutions of the European Union and the European member states saying that they want Article 50 invoked as soon as possible. It is entirely up to the UK when that happens. I would guess it was not likely to be in the short term. It is likely to be in that period that David Cameron mentioned earlier. Article 50 triggers the two-year exit period of the UK. That two-year period can only be extended by a agreement of all the member states. It needs to be a unanimous extension, and it is recognised that that two-year period will not be extended. There is no appetite from the other member states to agree an extension to that period. So therefore, what happens when it's triggered? Well, that's to be discussed, but during that process, during that two-year time period, essentially the UK is going to be doing three things. It's going to be negotiating the terms of the exit itself, for example, the budget, what will happen to rebates, what will happen to all of the economic contributions and political contributions to the institutions of the EU. It will be negotiating the UK's ongoing relationship with the EU and what that will look like, and whether it will look like a trade union, whether those discussions will break down and we will be free to negotiate with individual member states. We don't have clarity, of course, at this stage on anything like what the UK's relationship will be going forward. What the UK will also be doing is looking to third countries and negotiating trade deals. The UK is now free to negotiate its own trade deals with the US, with China, with other countries, and that will be an incredibly important part of that two-year process for the UK. There is a wrinkle to all this, and that is Scotland. And if you've seen the news over the last couple of hours, the leader of the Scottish Parliament, Nicola Sturgeon, has said that she will almost certainly call for a second Scottish referendum. This complicates matters. There's no formal process, of course, about the timing of that referendum, the terms of that referendum, what that referendum would look like, and how it would affect a wider UK withdrawal from the EU. So as we sit here today, the Scottish influence, I think, will be keenly felt, but it's very difficult at this stage to establish how it's going to affect the UK's negotiation of the Article 50 withdrawal. So that's on timing. I'm just going to hand over to Ian now, who's going to talk about some of the more medium-term effects on the legislation dealing with the asset management industry.
Thank you, Tim. So what I'd like to do is just talk about really four core areas of regulation and legislation that impact very fundamentally on the asset management industry. And really to just help people understand how we think over the medium term, some of these areas have the potential to be impacted both by the exit of the UK and whatever the post-Brexit regulatory and trade environment looks like in the UK and the EU. One point that I would make, and which I'm sure has occurred to many other people, is that all of these issues are likely to be examples of double entry bookkeeping, because every change that is required to accommodate the UK's exit at a European level is potentially then going to have some correlating domestic regulatory impact in the UK. I'd like to start with the most obvious one for the alternative investment management industry, and that is, of course, AIFMD, the Alternative Investment Fund Managers Directive. In the medium term, the first question I'd ask is, does Brexit potentially present a significant disruption to commercial operations which are being conducted under the auspices of AIFMD? And I think the answer to that has to be no, because there has been a very limited uptake of the passporting rights that are created by the framework for AIFMD. So in terms of disruption to an established business model, it would seem that in the medium term, Brexit won't fundamentally impact things you are doing under the auspices of AIFMD. What the AIFMD regime potentially is a candidate for medium-term reform of some sort, both from a domestic perspective in the UK, where potential deregulation of some sort of the alternative investment fund management industry may be an attractive opportunity for a new government. And secondly, at the EU level, to reflect the fact that the UK has become, for AIFMD purposes, a third country. That's particularly potentially relevant because one of the inequities that many of us on this call would identify in AIFMD as European regulation is that the alternative investment fund management industry, whether it's the private equity industry, whether it's the real estate fund industry, whether it's the hedge fund industry, the infrastructure funds, it is not really a European-wide industry. That is a very London-centric part of the financial services industry with the greatest, by far the greatest concentration of operations regulated by that directive in London and nowhere else in Europe. I'd like to touch also briefly on the UCITS regime, which is the European Mutual Fund regime. And this is an area where there is, in the medium term, potential for a great deal more disruption to be caused to existing business models by Brexit. That reflects two issues that are born out of the UCITS regime. The first one of which is the passporting framework for UCITS management companies creates a framework where many UK domiciled asset management businesses have passported out of the UK to enable them to act as the management company or the manager of non-UK domiciled UCITS funds. So that the passporting and management company rights is much more important under the UCITS directive than any passporting provisions under AIFMD. The second area for potential significant disruption is the use of the fund passport regime under UCITS for non-UK domiciled funds, the fund products themselves, to passport into the UK. The UK is one of, obviously, the biggest institutional investor markets in Europe, and there is significant investment by European institutional investors in UCITS regulated fund products that have passported into the UK, with the highest concentrations of those products being Irish domiciled funds and Luxembourg domiciled funds. Those issues, and particularly the second issue of the high concentration of institutional investment in non-UK UCITS funds, probably make the UCITS regime a higher priority for reform and some sort of Brexit-related solution over the medium term. I'd like to touch also briefly on the MiFID regime, the Markets in Financial Instruments Directive. MiFID is another area where, in the broadest sense, there is potential for very significant disruption to be wrought on people's commercial operations by Brexit. That is most fundamentally likely to be felt in the banking sector, where a number of investment banks rely on MiFID-related passporting rights either to enable them to operate and exist in the UK, typically in the City of London. Many European headquartered banks have significant operations in the city which rely on the domestic home state entity passporting in. And of course, you have the European operations of a number of international banks and UK domiciled banks relying on MiFID passporting rights to allow them to do business across the EU. And that, from an investment perspective, obviously has potential to impact significantly on values in the financials sector. The more direct impacts operationally for investment managers relate really to a trend, reflect a trend in recent years for the increased use of segregated accounts, which in many cases rely on a UK-based investment management business passporting out of the UK in order to manage a segregated mandate for a continental investor. And secondly, marketing of investment products generally, whether they are AIFs, whether they are UCITS funds, in some cases even 40 Act funds from the US, having marketing activities which are being conducted on a cross-border basis in other EU jurisdictions by asset managers relying on MiFID passports. The MiFID debate is likely to be led very much by the concerns of the banking sector and the impacts that that will have for that sector. The last area I will touch on, which is susceptible to impact here, is the market abuse regime. Now, obviously, that doesn't create any passporting framework. It is not a framework of legislation that is designed to facilitate cross-border activity. So it is a less obvious candidate for disruption, change, amendment in the medium term. But nonetheless, watch this space. At that point, I'd like to hand over to Chris Leonard. And Chris is very kindly going to take us through a few things that we think people should be considering as likely to impact on a shorter time horizon than some of those slightly more existential points I've just made.
Great, thanks, Ian. It won't have escaped any of your notice that there's been a significant amount of market volatility during the course of the morning here in Europe, and no doubt as the US markets get going as we speak, that there will be volatility also in the US. The key difference, I think, between what we're seeing today and the situation that we saw back in 2008 is that following 2008, the UK and EU regulators significantly improved the number and qualities of the tools available to them to control significant market events. Specifically, I'm sure you all know, within the EU short selling regulation, which includes prohibitions on naked shorts and requires disclosure of certain short positions. But baked into the short selling regulation is a power for all UK or all EU regulators, which as of today continues to include the UK regulator, to impose additional prohibitions on the short sale of any class of security, restrictions on the use of sovereign credit default swaps, or indeed to impose additional disclosure obligations in what the regulation refers to as exceptional circumstances. And I think it's fair to describe what we are currently seeing today as an exceptional circumstance. The regulation says that those additional measures can be imposed where there is an adverse event or development which constitutes a serious threat to financial stability or market confidence in the member state concerned, and where the measure is necessary to address the threat and will not have a detrimental effect on the efficiency of markets disproportionate to its benefits. Now, we haven't seen any market intervention from regulators yet today. However, I think we should all be alive to the possibility that this tool will be used in the coming days or weeks. Specifically, in order to use use this power, a regulator must provide the European Securities and Markets Authority, ESMA, with 24 hours notice of the implementation of the particular measure. During that 24 hours, ESMA will consider it and issue an opinion as to whether the exceptional circumstances test has been met. Assuming it does, the particular measure will be published on the websites of both the relevant national regulator and on ESMA. No doubt these things will be announced through the normal market news services, but I think keeping a weather eye on the website of ESMA in particular will be sensible over the next short period of time to ensure that you're fully aware of any particular developments in the short selling space. Ian has mentioned it already, but the market abuse regime creates an interesting situation in that the EU market abuse regulation, which is a EU regulation with direct effect and therefore does not have to be implemented into national law, is due to and will come into effect on the 3rd of July. Now, you know, that creates the interesting political and constitutional question that having elected to leave the EU, we will now have the direct impact of an EU market regulation coming into effect for the first time in the next 2 weeks. However, I think the important point to note is that in terms of how market abuse and in particular insider trading is defined, there is no significant change. The definition of inside information reflects the current UK position, which is that the information relates to the security, is non-public, it's precise, it indicates circumstances that either exist or might reasonably be thought to come into existence, and is likely to have a significant effect. That is information that a reasonable investor would take into account when making their investment decision. The important point, of course, is to note for those of you in the US, in particular, two points, in fact. The first is that there is no requirement for there to be a breach of duty in the disclosure of that information for it to constitute inside information. And probably most importantly of all is that the market abuse regulation, the EU market abuse regulation, applies to all trading on European markets, no matter where that trading takes place. So if you're trading in, if you're executing a trade in New York on an EU market, you are within the scope of that regulation. Finally, I will just touch on a slightly longer-term horizon, which is MiFID, the Markets and Financial Instruments Directive, which Ian has already mentioned. Many of you will have heard a lot about MiFID II, which is the update evolution to the existing directive. It's a fairly, that update is a fairly significant piece of legislation on its own. It is due to come into effect, or at least it is required to be implemented into the national laws of each member state by January 2018. Now, on the timetable that Tim outlined earlier, we do of course expect that the UK will continue to be a member of the European Union at that point in time, all things being equal. So I think it is reasonable to assume at this point that MiFID II will continue to be implemented into UK legislation on the basis of that same timetable. And on a mild note of optimism, there are reasons to think that that might be a good idea for the UK government to continue to pursue that implementation project. The reason for that is that built into MiFID II, for the first time, is the concept of a third country passport. That is, that a financial services business which has a license from a jurisdiction that the EU deems to be equivalent to the MiFID regime will be permitted to passport into the EU. So if you were based in the US and the EU deems the US to be equivalent, you will now for the first time be able to passport into Europe from the US. Now, MiFID II was as a directive and as an update to the existing framework directive, was supported by the UK government, and there's been no material objection really from the UK financial services industry. So as I say, one, the UK is expected to be a member of the EU when this thing is due to be implemented, and two, from a policy point of view, there is no reason why the UK government would divert from that now at this stage. So I think although the EU clearly has good reason to be slightly irritated with the United Kingdom this morning, it will be very difficult for them to argue that UK law is not equivalent to that of the EU, bearing in mind that they are in fact exactly the same law. So it should at least, in theory, at least be possible that assuming MiFID II is implemented into UK national law, as I believe it will be, that UK firms will at least, the possibility of UK firms being able to continue to passport into the EU will remain. But of course, it's difficult to say that with any degree of certainty this morning. So that really sort of wraps up the three things I wanted to mention. But Tim, I think you wanted to talk again a little bit about fund operations.
Yeah, we're just going to finish off very, very briefly, again, with sort of some of the bitter memories from 2008, talk about liquidity and contingency planning in relation to fund products, particularly open-end fund products. Whilst at the moment, obviously, we're seeing a lot of market gyration, we haven't had any solvency issues or really liquidity issues in the market, but we just wanted to highlight that if that happens, people obviously need to start thinking about potentially at least looking at their liquidity management and contingency planning in their funds and their fund documentation.
Obviously the concern is that a diminution in the functioning of markets could in these circumstances potentially be accompanied by a significant drop in investor confidence, which leads to significant volume of redemption requests and withdrawal requests being received by open-ended fund managers. As a general proposition, there have not been significant changes to relevant legislation in the key offshore centres, or for those of you looking at UCITS-related products, the key onshore centres that have overhauled the mechanisms that might enable you to limit the liquidity that is being offered to investors. So some of the unfortunate and unpleasant lessons a few of us learned in 2008 were that, first of all, it's important to keep the question of suspensions, gating, and those similar mechanisms under review, and wherever possible to seek to take a decision to implement those mechanisms as far in advance of the relevant dealing date or valuation date as you can. One of the areas that opened up post-financial crisis litigation with respect to open-ended funds in a number of jurisdictions were situations where the governing body of the fund purported to implement restrictions on liquidity or suspensions of valuation and liquidity in circumstances where the relevant date had passed. So as I'm sure many of you are already doing, it's important to understand what the mechanisms are for you to deploy if they need to be deployed to protect the interests of investors across the funds, and also to ensure that you have access to the individuals you need to make those decisions, particularly those of you who rely on offshore non-resident directors to exercise those discretions. There is, of course, an additional overlay on this issue for those of you who are full-scope European AIFMs, because under AIFMD, you are, of course, subject to and required to have in place a liquidity management policy, which is conceivably something which might need to be invoked at some point over the course of the coming weeks or months. The final point, just to touch on, which really reflects conversations we've been having with clients on this topic over the last month or so, which is the question of, well, what contingency plans should we be putting into place? What should we be doing now? It's very difficult, clearly, with the degree of uncertainty that this situation prevents, to look sensibly at contingency planning and decision making. It is notable that there are already reports filtering out of the banking sector of large banking operations announcing moves of personnel and operations out of the UK to other European financial centres. I think the important issue from an asset management industry perspective is to run a swift and meaningful analysis of where your exposures are, and then seeking to start to identify those areas where you actually should implement some form of contingency planning if you see a propensity for disruption to your operations caused by upheavals in the either political or regulatory and legislative frameworks around Europe.
Thanks everyone for dialing in today. We're going to wrap it up there. This is the first of our calls. We will be scheduling them relatively frequently, depending on what news comes out, to keep you all updated. Obviously, if anyone has specific questions, please contact your normal contact at Akin Gump, and hopefully we can be of assistance. But once again, thank you very much for dialing in.